Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on the zero emission future that we all hope for. Every week, as always, I'm joined by one of the wonderful team within the EV Cafe. And that this week is the lovely, mostly lovely, John Curtis.
I think that's a compliment, almost. Hello.
Hey, John. So this week, John, we have got, as always, a pioneer, an innovator, a collaborator in our industry, Marcus Müller from Pionix, and he is the CEO and founder. But having dug around, Marcus, Marco.
I was about to go there.
Yeah.
Actually, with such a special German name, you're getting flexible in how other pronounce it.
Okay, so we'll go with Marco. We're not gonna edit this out. We're just gonna carry on because it just shows. Anyway,
really, really fun being here. I already see this getting a great show.
Good. Well, that's a good start. I got your name wrong, but you know, hey.
Let's go with Marcus Müller.
Marcus Müller. Yeah, let's pick a name. Any name. Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Marco, in my sort of research, what I discovered was a deep sense of inadequacy because you have studied extensively. You are a degree qualified physicist. That's right, yeah?
Yes.
Develop all kinds of software. You've built and moved on from a number of companies. I mean, it's an impressive CV. And you know, when I look at you, I'd see a young man. And you might not feel that, but being old, I see a young man. So it's an impressive start to life. Talk us through what you do today and a little bit about how you got here, just in a brief snapshot.
Yes, brief snapshot. That's not my qualification. So, yes, I'm Marco. I'm one of the co-founders of Pionix. Have a background in physics and computer science and, let's say, in startups. So what we do right now is the Android for EV chargers, like a common operating system which runs on every kind of charging infrastructure, from your home wall box to a public slow AC charger to a highway supercharger. All they need firmware running on that boxes. I'm not talking about any cloud things here. But on the other end, all of them actually need the same software because they always have to do the same task, talk to your back office, talk to all kind of different cars, maybe to some utilities. So it's perfect for sharing that software across the industry. And that's what we do. We drive that sharing transition towards open source. And we have, meanwhile, amazing amount of collaboration. And we can talk about that. And what we did before, and maybe how we got there, that's also an interesting story. We had a drone company before, created that during studying, me and some friends. We have been doing mapping drones, so for all kind of road construction work or mining work. And when we did that, we did all the software, all the hardware ourselves. And then we sold the company. And shortly afterwards, a big disruption happened to our industry. So everyone was flipping to open source. So the problem of flying was actually solved by open source perfectly. So then it was only about the use case. Yeah, and our acquirer was a bit slow with that transition, including us. So we left that drone space, but it was an interesting lesson we learned. And now we try to apply this lesson to the EV charting space.
So let me just pick up on a couple of things there, Marco, if I may. Open source. Well, my understanding of open source is that there is a base level of information which is put into the marketplace, and a number of collaborators come together to use that open source data to be able to modify it, change it, input to it. Is that right?
Yeah, so you're talking about data. Yes, if you think about Wikipedia, then it would be data. Mm-hmm. We're talking here about really source code, so the language talking to the computer and telling him what he has to do. And that is the stuff we share. So it's like, I don't have the exact numbers. Let's say 500,000 lines of C++ code defining how a charging station should work.
Understood. And the code that you have in the firmware that speaks to and from the chargers Is it consistent? So if I have a charger from ABB and I have another charger from Tritium, do they use the same firmware, or is it a specific firmware for each charger?
So at the moment, many big companies, especially the ones you're naming, are doing firmware themselves. So in a way, everyone is reinventing the wheel. It's a bit like with the drone story. Everyone themselves try to make a brick fly, make the drone fly, even though flying is a solved problem. So in a way, they put this gentle, they're wasting money on trying to solve something which is also available out there for free. And this takes some time until everyone adopts that, all the industry changes. So the example you brought, up to my knowledge, we have a bit of deeper insight. They're not doing open source here. If they would do open source, I couldn't talk about that probably because I have NDAs signed all over the place. But let's say those kind of companies, there's quite a few who now starting their future product generations based on open source because they realized 90% of the software within their chargers could actually be the same as with their competitors, but it isn't. So they're wasting money on, let's say, pure me too engineering. And what we now try to orchestrate is that this is shared. It's getting cheaper. It's getting a better quality for them. And yeah, this transition just takes time because you have this industrial product. They have 1 to 2 years engineering time frame. So I see already a lot of, let's say, tsunami happening in the background, which is not yet, let's say, surfaced.
It's interesting because we've tried, you know, I've heard about open source software. I think there was a couple of vehicle manufacturers that started to talk about
Toyota
it.
Toyota did it.
I think Saab it was who I was thinking of at the time, but you know, before they went bust, and they were starting to incorporate open source software in terms of satellite navigation stuff. And there's been many times, and forgive me if this sounds harsh, there's been many times it's sort of come to the edge and the precipice and been talked about, but it always seems to have dropped away. No. And the other element to it, and if I can have a two-part question, the other element to it is open source. I get the impression, and I'm probably wrong here, but it's sort of made available almost for free. So where's the commercial model? How does that work? Because if you're giving away stuff, that's usually the business of a charity rather than a business.
Yeah, totally fair question. Also, the second question is like the typical thing like I always get from investors, like, okay, you're giving it away. How do you make money? Let me anyway start with the first question. So is it going away? Is it just a hype cycle? I don't think so. I mean, server side, let's say open source is very often not visible. Like, I would assume 80% of the audience having an Android phone, this is all Linux-based. So Android itself is open source. Then if you're communicating to a web server, like we now in this podcast, I would say 90% of the what drives this meeting right now is open source. So it's happening between the industry players. It's not often like this open source on your laptop, Linux desktop. That had a hard time. But it's built in basically every industrial product. And I think more than 90% of the web servers are running Linux. And all along the tech stack, you see that. And also, if you look to the charging stations, if I ignore the really, really dumb wall boxes or the glorified power plugs, if I ignore them, then I would say 99.9% runs with Linux already. So there is already open source. So we're not doing us that dramatic shift that we say like, oh no, there was no open source before. No, it's all open source. No, what we're saying is like before it was, I don't know, 20% of the added value was open source. Lines of code, probably more, but open operating system Linux is not that worthy anymore because it's used so massively everywhere. Then 80% was commodity, and it was not commodity, it was made by the manufacturers. So we just want to shift that. We want to up-level that. So we'll never reach, in our business plan, let's say, full surface, that 100% of a charging station will be open source. But we want to shift that level from, let's say, pure operating system to adding all the car communication, the cloud communication, the energy management, like everything what is commodity within charging. And this happened to so many industries. And we also see it massively happen in EV charging. So even if my company would go bust, that is staying. And it, by the way, not looking bad for us, but this this got already so much a momentum that it's self-sustainable. I mean, in the beginning, if you have come with that an idea like us to the market, you're investing a lot. I think we invested, I think 5 to 10 million euros already in this open source. So quite a bit of money to get this working. So why doing that investment? To come to your next question. Because let me start with a quote from another industry maker. Databases, you maybe know SAP, Oracle, this big company is doing quite some money there. There's a famous quote from the founder of MySQL, which is quite successful. You want to create a $1 billion market out of a $10 billion market. So he's shrinking the market, but afterwards it's his ones. So also in a way that applies to us. So yes, EV charging engineering will get cheaper, but afterwards, a lot of them will probably collaborate with us. And we have, let's say, a soft business model. That means you can go full with open source. It's feature complete. You can build an entire charging station out of that. But what we often see is that especially corporate customers, they want to have someone who's liable, someone who they can call at midnight if something doesn't work, who's picking up the phone and getting it fixed. And that's our role. So that's not everyone will need that services, but those who need that services, we're happy here to help. So in my business planning, we say like 30%-ish maybe need our support. And the 70% will go with a fully free version.
Wow. Okay.
And then the trick is to make the cake really, really large, and then you may be fine with that 30%.
But it's kind of like the I suppose, sort of how Facebook and Twitter and Instagram all came to market with the free version of. And I always kind of went, well, how are they valued at billions? But it's your users, isn't it? So if you sort of base your world around a percentage of people that are using your free stuff that will then pay for extra stuff, then you've got a business model, right?
So there's actually also more parts of the business model. Not everything here is released, but let's say in a way we're focusing currently on the firmware and getting that to an enterprise level is, let's say, our paid service. Also, the open source version has, let's say, quite some level. So the US government has been putting, I think, an 8-people team fully on that open source project to promote it in North American industry and to improve the quality. And we have, I think, meanwhile, like more than 100 active engineers every month. So in total, I think it was already more than 300 from different corporates who work on actually actively contributing to that code base. So passively using, it's probably even more. So what I want to say is like there's quite some momentum in usage base out there. And for some fraction, we're doing this added services with, let's say, commercial grade. And then there's also other things you can do on top of that. Let's say helping your customers with analytics, helping your customers with remote configuration. So there's always, let's say, a certain catch. With an open source world, this business model is, enterprise services. We do that. And then on top of that, we're also doing, let's say, open core. So we have a huge core, which is open. But on top of that, there's some services which are not open where we make money. Wow. It's a bit like with Android phone, like the Android is free, all is open source, but Google Maps is not open source. And if you're Samsung, you want to get a proper Android phone out there, you go to Google and pick the one with Android.
Right. So it's actually quite a clever business model, isn't it?
It is, and it doesn't rely on things like intellectual property. Because a lot of the value in a business is the things they invent and the things that they bring to market. But you don't have that almost asset.
Yeah, so our main asset to having to being at the core of this open source community and being the go-to people. I mean, we invented that whole thing. We are organizing and aligning this hundreds of engineers around the globe. So we're kind of in every working group and every committee. We keep that machine running. And yes, probably it would also run without us. But the typical behavior of open source is who comes there first and shows some activity and is not that dumb, he stays in power. If you look on the Linux kernel, it was invented by Linus Torvald. Like Linux, you see, it's his name. And he's still like the core gatekeeper. Everything goes into the kernel of Linux. So... and that typically applies. If a company invented an open source project and they're taking care of it, they will be the go-to people.
So you've decided to focus on an element of charging, which is actually, and forgive me for saying this, but it's one of the Cinderella products in that nobody really knows about it. It's firmware. It's invisible. It sits within a product and nobody cares. They just expect it to work rather than focusing on the things which the market seems to focus on about interoperability and not having loads of RFID cards to access chargers and payments and all the other elements of software. What made you focus on firmware as the key area that you would be involved with? Because it is the least sexy of all of the bits, in my humble opinion.
Many possible answers. I think German startups maybe have a tendency to go to this deep down engineering things. And I think Californian startups have the tendency to go to flashy, great user interfaces. So maybe that is part of the story. I don't know. The second part of the story is, I mean, we have been firmware people in the drone space. And it was just overlooked, probably for the reasons you just mentioned. No one realized that that is something you can scale horizontally across industries. And this is a pain point you have to solve. So there's huge pain. All the points you just mentioned, like interoperability. Honestly, this is on us. We have to make it work with every car out there, with every different firmware release, with every different, let's say, configuration option of that car. This is a hard problem. At the moment, everyone is solving that individually. So we can scale solving that problem. It doesn't feel obvious that there is a solution like us, but if you look deeper, it's like an obvious solution. You can look in so many other industries. It happened before. And so in a way, we have been lucky to realize that there's, let's say, a copycat startup in this industry missing. Copycat in terms of we're taking the learnings from other industry, how they solved their problems, and taking the approach to EV charging. And it was just overlooked so far. So lucky us.
I mean, it's a great philosophy because the reality is, I mean, I'm quite close to a lot of vehicles that come to market. And, you know, when you plug them in the first time to a particular charger, you're always going to go, yeah, exactly. A small prayer goes skyward. Exactly. To say, will the gods of charging allow me some electrons, please? You know, and that's kind of where we go. But you know, many times we are happy. And but many times there is a frantic email to somebody somewhere that has created the charge point to say, please, can you do the handshake and work it all out? Yeah. Is that the world that you're in? Are you working out those connections and joining those dots?
Yes. So, yeah, totally. I mean, at the end of the day, we have to test every vehicle. We have to test every back office. We have to test the future, every solar inverter, to make everything work with everything. And so, sorry, I'm a physicist, but I have to show you once where I'm coming from. This is called complexity explosion. If you, let's say, have X different types of charging station, if you have Y different types of car, then the amount of combinations you would have to test is X times Y. And if you have, let's say, and then if you have maybe Z different back offices, let's say X, Y, Z is all 1,000, then this is a billion of combinations. You can't test a billion of combinations. There's not so many engineers in our industry. So how do you do that? You're reducing complexity. And reducing complexity is by, let's say, let's find out one spot where we could attack. And we just unify that. So in theory, in a monopole would be best. If there's only one type of charging station, then everyone agrees on whatever, let's say, the Tesla supercharger is doing is right. Even though the standard says different, I ignore the standard. If it works with Tesla superchargers, I'm good. But we're not in a monopoly way world, luckily. But I'm saying monopoly would be perfect. So how do I solve that? They go the open source route, because that's in a way a friendly monopoly. So you can share software and a product across industry without anyone has to be afraid. Because if I not behave, you can just take the software and go. You can just continue it on your own. If the project's doing you don't like, you can fork it and just went with part of the community through a certain direction. So there's no scenario where me and my startup could be harmed. So everyone is luckily joining that. So it creates some momentum, and then you get this open source flywheel. So as more is there on one plate, as more people are testing with that, so as better it gets. And if people are testing with that, maybe some percent of that are even contributing the bug fix, so we don't have to do that. So we can, in a way, outsource debugging to the other end. So if this got enough momentum, then the car manufacturers will start to say, like, okay, we don't care what the standard says in a way. We just try to stick compatible with Everest. And in many industries, you have that situation. Let's go for websites. So you're old enough to understand this analogy. Maybe you remember the browser wars in the early 2000s. I do. I'm not that young as I look, what people tells me. I don't know why. So in the browser wars, initially you had on every website this, oh, this website is VW3C compliant and it was tested and I did everything right with the standard, so it should work with every browser. But it was praying. So typically then the next line said, yes, it was tested, but better try this with Netscape or with Internet Explorer 2.0. So then it should work. How has that resolved? I mean, meanwhile, there's only two browser engines left. The Chromium engine, which is part of Opera, Internet Explorer, Google, and then there's the Firefox engine. So if you're creating your website, you just have to test these two engines. Honestly, probably just test the one engine, then you're good. So having on one end of the wire a less complexity makes testing for everyone easier, makes life for everyone easier. If you want to innovate, you just contribute to that edge. Like if you want to have a new 3D browser game and then you're missing some functionality in the Chrome engine, you're just adding it, add it. No one will stop you. So you can also push innovation way faster forward. And that's, yeah, again, what we copied. And
do you live your life that way, Marco? Do you do you boil down complexity into very, very simple models? Is that a universally applied approach that you have as a human being?
So as a human being, I sometimes getting complained that I try to explain too much complexity and try to include too much into the picture. So I try to reduce it. But during studying, I was having a lot of, let's say, volunteer groups where we exchanged on, okay, how does this complex system lecture work? Can you help me? And I was doing this lot of voluntary lecturing. And meantime, I'm doing that in my free time and part of the Scientists for Future Climate Movement in Germany. And yes, I'm doing breaking down of green transition, climate change for the public audience.
Because that's critical. This is what Paul and I spend our lives doing. We're far less qualified than you to do so, but we use simple models to explain complex ideas. And I think a great deal of what we all seem to do is the communication of a very complex thing in a simple way. So if you were to give an elevator pitch for what it is you do, what would that be?
Okay, again, so I should give you my fifth pitch. So we try to harmonize the firmware on all the charging stations out there using, let's say, an Android-like approach, so one software stack to charge them all. And we're doing that by having a huge open source ecosystem we orchestrate, and we gain for world domination with that. And then for some of those customers, we offer commercial services around that software stack, whoever's interested.
Got it.
And isn't that clever? Because I love that little bit, because you dropped in world domination, and it kind of
as you do.
And so obviously the Elon Musk complex, but it's funny, isn't it? There's a story, you know, whether it's a fable or what, but the building of the Tower of Babel, where everybody came together and worked with one language and one purpose, and they were building this tower that would go up to God. And it feels like that's what's happening here. You're getting a language that everybody speaks so that we can make the very complex simple, and therefore we can achieve world domination. I mean, have I understood it right? Is my analogy a bit weird?
I would say that works. And I think but also world domination sounds a bit militaric and, let's say, negative. But I think the positive spin here is, like, it's a community who works together and solving a really, really big puzzle. And the puzzle is way too large for any individual to solve. I think that is what e-mobility has proven over the last years, that some people maybe get it sometimes right, but not always. And then there may be only niche players only playing in a certain segment. So even if they get one segment perfect, they don't get the other segments. And to covering all of that, I think it's a task too big for any one of us. So we have to find together. And but like this is a pitch which is, how to say, a bit not business driven enough. So if I speak to a C-level engineer, like a C-level counterpart, any of our customers or partners, yeah, they ask me, where's the money? So this pitch might sound like in a newspaper or on a podcast, and actually it's true, but this is not how I get them in. I get them with different metrics, and the metric is like, hey, you get it. He has to do, have to do less work. You maybe even have to do nothing. You can just sleep down, lay down, wait for the others to do that. Some of them will, some of them won't. But at the end of the day, you're getting a better product, so more bang for the buck. And if we've, and there's no risk involved, so where's the catch? There is no catch. Yes, I have a business model, but you don't have to take it. So you're not worse off as you are now on your own. So you're better off. And maybe with my help, even much better, but that's for you to decide later.
How do you steer these projects? Because it fascinates me. You talk about community, yes. And community is like a jelly. It kind of moves and flexes, and it goes in weird shapes and does unexpected things. How do you retain control over the general direction of product development?
To a certain extent, you can't, you shouldn't, because otherwise you became a dictator. You should never become a dictator, because that is not healthy for the community. Mm-hmm. So it's a journey. We're just learning that. I think last year we grew 5 to 10x in community times. This was an incredible hard journey for us. I think now we have more, 100 active engineers who actively contribute, passively asking questions. It's a couple of hundreds around the globe. And so we are part of the Linux Foundation, which is the biggest open source governance body in the world with this project. And then you have like a steering committee for every project that makes some, high-level decision and resolves disputes, because someone want to go left, someone else want to go right. What should we do? Is this code good enough, or does it have to be changed before we can accept it? Things like that you resolve there. But we now have been in the Linux Foundation in the energy space, which is like our sub part of the Linux community. I think they still have 40 projects to manage, so it's still quite large corner. We've been the biggest project, and we're now suddenly from the newcomer to the role model. So I'm always asking myself, we did a lot of things right. Maybe have some ideas what we did right. But in the end of the day, it's accepting that you're not controlling everything. You can't force people. You have to create this momentum. You have to invite and give away. Then with a lot of luck, you get also something in return. I think that worked out. And we're globally active. We're engaging with everyone we can. And that paid out.
You trust the process.
Yes. And then I trusting that some momentum will evolve. And then we try to figure it out. Well, for example, what we figured out last time year, I think end of the year, we have been our weekly calls with 50 engineers. That's not productive anymore. So we started to split this project. So now we have working groups taking care of different subdomains of the project, like car communication, cloud communication, framework testing, and so on. And then there's one project manager we donating to that groups who organizes that and take the meeting minutes, create an appointment, reminds people of things. But then the members of that working groups are cross company, whoever's interested can join. And that also even accelerated that entire process more. So we always push as hard as we can, then we're getting overwhelmed, that we try to figure out how to deal with the situation, and then this is the next step. And they're always step by step on our journey.
Understood.
it's such an exciting journey. I genuinely am fascinated. I was slightly terrified before we came on this call, because felt like no, absolutely. I rely on people to go with Einstein's theory of if you don't know your subject well enough to explain it in the words of a six-year-old, you don't know it well enough. And I feel like the six-year-old that's getting the words, and it's good. And I'm understanding it. And more than that, more than understanding it, it actually quite excites me, because it's everything that we stand for as both the EV Cafe, and I think John and I as individuals, and the EV Cafe individuals, otherwise it wouldn't be the thing, but that the principle of communication, the principle of community, and the principle of collaboration, those three C's are the three C's that make make us go forward, right? You know, that community, that collaboration, that communication. And it just fascinates me. And I guess what fascinates me equally is the man that's sitting before us, because I'm, you know, I feel that I could sit down in a good bar with a oh, yeah. Stein and a Bratwurst, and we could spend some hours on this, because it's I'm all for it. But it's really, really fun, because so how did you get into this? Because like few people like you are born, and to be doing it right from the get-go, because I got your career from university, really, you know. So you were obviously a leader in university, you were pioneering some ideas, you were obviously got a very scientific mind. How did all that kind of, because it sounds like you're the kid that everybody wants to bully at school, but you know.
I think I there was also a part where I was also part of a bully, but also I was also bullied a lot, so. But
wow.
So how has that started? My dad had a farm. And after school, wow. I went home, and then there was this workshop, and I always spent my entire afternoon in the workshop, so I don't care about school. Then people around me told me always like, you will become a nature science. And in German language, nature science sounds a bit like biology, at least in the ears of a 6-year-old, like, no, I don't want to be a biologist. I want to do something like Daniel Düsentrieb, if you know this famous inventor from DuckTales. And anyway, I want to be a famous engineer.
Right.
So that was my plan as a 6-year-old. Then my dad transformed his business from, let's say, farming into a shop for beekeeping equipment. So we're a super weird niche. But as a, let's say, 10-year-old, I was selling. I was selling the entire day. And again, school was not that important for me. So and then you can't sell if you just like, buy this one. Like, you have to explain people how that works and why is something better than the other one. You have to understand what they're looking for, feel their mind model, and then go into that. So that's where I got a certain spin-off. And then I was super bad at school, at least in the language, like English, German. I was almost had to repeat a class. Then they almost managed it. Then in Germany, we have like different grade levels of schools. So I was just getting to the middle one, which is not that good. But then after a while, I think in sixth grade, I decided, so come on, I forget about what I can't do. I just focus on my strengths. Then I got really good in school. And okay, I still had, let's say, a D in English. But it doesn't matter if like an A everywhere else. So and that became kind of philosophy to me. Like I have this drive and I do things where I have fun of. Then in Germany we had this. So then after 10th grade I was not qualified for university yet. So I first learned a job at Bosch Blaupunkt, so car component makers. Mm-hmm. I learned how to fix radios in a car radio factory. And then there was one teacher coming like, look, there's this young scientist competition here. You want to make a project? And like, oh, yes, I want. And then it's a bit like the science fairs, I think, you have where kids build volcanoes and present that. In Germany, it's a bit different. You're super free. You can do whatever you want. Just do something, present it at the end of the day. And we have built a system for buses to track them and to show when they will arrive at the next bus stop. That was 1999. So before that happened everywhere else, the idea comes from a teacher like, okay, I can make that happen. We made it happen. We won quite some prize in that. So then fast forward, I really love this community around this young scientist because they're universally interested. In the evening in the bar, you get one table is discussing quantum mechanics, the other table is discussing virology and how this gene editing works. And like, oh, I love those people. And then there was alumni club of this young scientist competition. I went in there, met my co-founders there. I even steered that club for some years. So again, networking people. That was quite some journey on my education track. I finished my job at Bosch. Then I made another year of school. Then I went to university. Became quite good. And then made my PhD and double degree in the bachelor. So that was kind of this parallel track, like, my private engagement with young scientists then turned into a startup, and my education degree kind of the doctorate degrees, it was already on the sideline because startup was so big. And yeah, sorry, have I answered your question?
Yeah, hell yeah. Wow, I'm with John. See that face that John had there? I'm exactly there.
But end of the day, I just loving understanding things and loving to make models and then talking about that. That was always, and Mars is my all-time favorite, but I can't apply it so much anymore. That's a bit sad.
But do you know what, Marco, you said something in all of that that really jumped out at me, because it's something that I really relate to. So listen, I was bad at school and stayed bad, and came out of school with nothing. I don't have anything to this day, but one of the things that you said there is, well, yeah, apart from a nice podcast, yes, indeed. But forget about what I can't do. And do you know what? I think that is so fundamental to us growing up as humans. Forget about what you can't do, because we can't all do everything, right? We can do, most of us, if not all of us, have a superpower. And do you know what? The superpower is often the thing that other people laugh at or think is weird or get a bit crazy or cranky about or becomes the butt of a joke. But actually, the one thing... So my superpower is my selfie stick. You might not know anything about this, but I get my selfie stick out, which is it's just here. So you put the camera on the end there and I walk around and I talk. Yeah. So that was my superpower. I suddenly found that I could talk to a camera and it was fun. And it was the thing that I became good at. And there's other things as well, but vans, commercial vehicles, I'm good at vans. Okay. But you fall in love with something and yes, you find that you've got a natural ability for it, and then you focus on it. And I think, gosh, that you have maxed that out, haven't you?
Yeah, that was really my tipping point in school. So after from almost repeating classes and ending up in the bottom of the German education system to having a good scholarship, a couple of studies. And this was really if I continued the usual route where, you have to get your extra lessons to learn better English. In the end of the day, I would say my English is okay-ish. People can understand me. But this came as a side effect because I focused on my superpowers and then everything else kind of happened.
What did you expect to be, Marco, when you were at school and things, it sounds, were quite tough for you? What did you want to be when you grew up?
As I said, a famous engineer. So a famous inventor or something like that. There was this cartoons, the DuckTales, Dagobert Duck.
Yeah, yeah.
The cartoons, there's this one inventor who always built the crazy helicopters for this rich billionaire. I wanted to be the crazy inventor.
And what's the thing that you're most proud of having delivered in your life?
Great question.
I think the first thing that came to my mind is I'm super happy with all I do at business and getting things running here and there. And it's another of my superpowers. I can fall in love with kind of every topic quite quickly and then dive into it. But what I'm proud of is... how I stick to my family, that we got the three kids. We grew that up, let's say, with a very equal relationship, me and my wife. Everyone took us the same amount of hours free for taking care of the kids. And I'm super proud of my three daughters and that we managed together to bring them there.
Are your daughters like you? Do they have that incredible energy that you have?
I think the incredible energy they have as well. They can also fall in love into topics and turn like crazy into something.
You have made the world a better place.
Absolutely.
But I'm not pushing my daughters to be an engineer or to learn a certain topic. My biggest daughter is really good in writing stories and everyone finds their spot. Just have the energy and look for it.
Yes. Oh, wow. I've been sort of ruminating on whether I should ask this question or not, because it's about the future a little bit. So, we've kind of got a really good picture, and I love the fact that you've got family is your bedrock, you know, really fundamental and the thing that you're most proud of. But in the future, and what it was somebody said to me, if you want to write a line of code that you're not really sure about, you can chuck it into ChatGPT and, you know, it kind of spins up this piece of code that might answer a question or give you an Excel. It's quite complicated. I tried to get an Excel formula, which didn't really work. But it's challenging, the thought of AI and how that's going to affect the landscape going forward, and particularly in your world and of software development or firmware development, I should say. How do you see AI? Is it a tool or a threat?
Okay, I have to give you different levels of answers. So to be honest, I'm not decided here. And this is one of my weaknesses, maybe superpower, I don't know, that I'm giving myself always a hard time with not being 100% black or white, because it's always in the middle. And that I'm sometimes jealous on people who can say it's black or white, that you have an easier life. So I think what I ask my engineers to tell me, like, look, this is a productivity tool, but it will never replace us, but you can be, I don't know, three times faster doing your job. So, okay. And then also saw someone in hype cycles where everything was promised, and then you ended up, I don't know, half the way, 40%, which is still a step forward, but it's probably overinflated expectation as well into this. So having said that, but then I know Elon Musk is a really debatable figure, but I'm with him on a certain aspect. This is now the physicist speaking out of me. If you look on the technology evolution over the last 200 years, it's incredible where we ended up. Then, and it feels like this is accelerating. Then if you look like, okay, extrapolate that 100 years in the future, is AI a threat to humanity? I don't know. Then maybe not. Maybe it's we're settling 10 years and we got stuck somewhere. But time plays against human in this equation, because you can build so much computers which can calculate so much. So I think there's a certain likelihood, maybe not 100%, that over time, maybe it's not 10 years, maybe it's 100 years, that this is taking over. So I also see a certain risk, but I also see the benefits. I'm super curious how this ends up. I can't tell you.
Damn, I thought I was going to get the answer eventually. No. Damn it.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, dear me.
He's some man, isn't he? He's some man. I've got to say. Because, yeah. Of course, I came onto this call thinking, don't really know Marco at all. And this whole area of firmware and software leaves me, you know, I learned ones and zeros at school. We called it binary. It was never going to mean anything to me. And so today I thought, oh, this is going to be a struggle. And what I've learned is that we're all just human beings. We're all just people. And there is so much consistency between Paul, myself, you, in terms of how we view the world and how we look to simplify, and a big smile. And it's all about those human qualities that you bring to it. You're very family orientated. And fundamentally, I've got this belief that it doesn't matter so much about the technology, the software, the hardware, the vehicles, whatever it is. People can make things work if we choose to.
Yes.
And we've made this work, I think.
Listen, I mean, the fact is, John, we could just go on for easily another hour with another 50 questions. And I mean, I'm so glad of the journey that you've been on. One of the things that we often ask people, because here we are, we've got a smiling, bright, energetic, positive person that looks like, you know, nothing has ever gone wrong. But we love to know what gets through people difficult times, right? So can you speak to us about a difficult time, a really hard time, one that stands out above almost all others, and where that took you to and how you got back?
So in a way, I feel I'm often got lucky. But I think there's even a theory behind it. It's kind of like increasing the luck surface, like making sure you find a lot of opportunities and then you're catching on something. And if something doesn't go up as planned, then just stick to the next luck. Something will come your way. A friend of mine told me, like, there's a once a year, once in a lifetime opportunity. So just increase your surface. But there was a hard time, and that's actually with our last startup. Everything was going great. We grew 4x a year, and we ended up with 30 people. And then suddenly our dealers realized, oh, we're overstocked. Sorry, we don't need anything from you for the next 10 months. So let's say 100% and even increasing production, going down to 10%, that was almost killing the company. But we had reserves, we had a great team, great co-founders, and we worked through that, like, okay, what should we go? Should we go to the bank? Can we save money somewhere? Do we find a buyer for that company? And yes, we found a buyer. It was also a great adventure with Intel. Also with corporate background, sometimes difficult. I don't want to go into details here. you can do that with a beer if you want. But this was like a time where, I don't know, 6 months, the getting acquired by a so big corporate as a so tiny startup. Like, we have been 30 employees. We had 30 lawyers. Intel had more than 100 lawyers. And the entire acquisition was mainly managed by me and my co-founder. This was just nuts and crazy on so many levels. And like, we had calls literally around the clock and then little sleep. And then that still feels surreal looking bad. But we just... Germany with the saying, close your eyes and go through it. So the way we did that, and it turned out.
Fantastic. I mean, but it's good to know that even a man with ideas and the passion that you have, you can kind of come up against things that you weren't expecting, but still get through. And I love the once a year you get a once in a lifetime opportunity. I like that. I've got two phrases from today that will be used again and again.
What is the second one? I'm curious.
The forget about what you can't do.
Ah, okay.
That's it. Mm. Yeah, forget about what you can't do, and a once in a lifetime opportunity. Once a year you get a once in a lifetime opportunity. Because I kind of feel that, you know. Yeah. Since I've been, you know, I stepped out of the corporate world about 3 years ago. I'd been in the safe world of a salary and all of that kind of stuff. And one of the issues, I'm not sure if I should put it publicly, but one of the issues was my public liability insurance. So I went to ask them a question about the public liability insurance. And they said, well, what do you do precisely? And I said, well, I've already got a policy with you, but okay, I'll tell you. So they told me, and the phone call came back a little bit later. They said, thanks for telling us all of that, Mr. Kirby. We can't insure you because I'm doing too many different things, and the professional liability and all of those kinds of stuff. And I'm like, damn, I haven't thought about this in my business. I haven't thought about all these things. But the flip side of that is doing lots of different things. You get a once in a lifetime opportunity almost every year, right? You know, things that you just think, wow, this is going to be great. And it disappears or it materializes, one or the other, you know. It's exciting.
I think you should just not take yourself down by being not lucky. I had friends from school who had... There's this glass half full, glass half empty thing. Do you have the same analogy in
the Yes, okay. yes. Yeah, yeah.
So, and they always saw only the bad things. And they kind of, in a way, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy for them.
Yep,
and for me, like, hey, come on, it's half full. We can do something out of this. We can refill it. We can, I don't know. We can do so many things of that. And maybe that also became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think you can choose to a certain extent.
You absolutely can. And that comes back to my point all about people. Yes. And we can if we choose to. What was it Henry Ford said? If you believe you can or believe you can't, you're probably right. Yeah, he is right.
Interest. Okay, that's a good one.
We've given you one. Yes.
Well, thank you.
If you think you can or you think you can't, you're definitely right. Probably right. But I mean, Marco, this has been great. Listen, I just want us to finish on a really clear picture of how you can help this transition, because your goal is to accelerate the transition to e-mobility, to electric transport. In again, just kind of remind us why and how. So we saw the Everest project. How can people engage with that? How can people kind of connect with you to, one, to support the project, but two, to kind of give you problems to solve? Because that's how all great entrepreneurs, you know, move forward, and how all best businesses are built. They're solving problems. What can you do for us? And how can we engage?
So first of all, you can find me on LinkedIn. My name probably that can be somewhere in the show notes, I guess.
Oh, yeah, it's there.
Just ping me. So if you want to, happy to exchange ideas. If you want to copy some ideas into another space, let's talk about that. If you want to join our journey on e-mobility open source, please engage. And we could probably also make a second link into the show notes to the Project Everest, where we have an entire compass, like an entire landing page on how and where can you engage, because there's so many options. If you don't find that, again, contact me. Jan, also, by the way, we're even paying people for doing open source coding, which sounds crazy because people do that as a hobby. So it's again, if you're interested in this journey as an engineer, contact me. And have I missed something from your question?
No, exactly. I mean, because I think, John, I don't know about you, but communication, community, collaboration, this is the golden key that unlocks that difficult door, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, John's on mute.
Oh, no.
Dog's barking. He gets dogs and they bark.
My apologies. what comes across really loud and clear is that with some knowledge, some enthusiasm, and some other people, we can achieve whatever we put our minds to. And it doesn't matter where you come from, what your start is. What is important is that you can change the course of your future and others by working hard, by working together, and just going for it. And that's the thing I've learned from Marco today.
Brilliant. Marco, yeah. What I've learned is that I can't wait to get to Germany and maybe get a beer with you. Whereabouts in Germany are you?
We're in the southwest, Karlsruhe, Heidelberg, or roughly Frankfurt Airport, 1 hour south.
Okay, I've been to Frankfurt. Yeah, I'm coming to Hanover this year to the IAA, the transport show.
Kind of my home turf. I was born 30 kilometers from Hanover, so I was on a lot of trade shows there. CeBIT, the computer show, I was kind of on everyone.
It's like me and commercial vehicles, isn't it, John?
Oh, yes. If there's a commercial vehicle, you'll be there.
20 years I've been going to that show. But yeah, the IAA, I was over there 22 years ago. So, and that was a fabulous show. So big. How big is that show?
Please be on the Power to Drive in Munich. I think it's 6 weeks from now. We really looked around. What will be the global leading trade show on e-mobility? And we have been at so many shows, and the Power to Drive is by far the biggest one. It's like five times bigger than everything I've seen somewhere else. And everyone I'm talking to says, like, okay, this is the leading show on EVs, on EV charging, particularly.
In particular, EV charging.
Charging, yeah. Like five big trade hall buildings full with charging, plus 20 halls with solar and plus 5 halls with batteries.
Wow. I think I need to go to that. I'm kind of excited to think, because I went to the solar storage show here in the UK, in London, in the XL. Quite a small show, to be fair. Probably 10,000 square feet or the meters or whatever. But it was interesting. It was really interesting, and I thought, you know, there's got to be innovation in this. But we were talking about it this morning on the news, John, weren't we?
We were.
That solar, batteries, and charging together make a really powerful proposition, and one again where you're taking the energy, free energy from the sun to your open source. I mean, that's the ultimate in open source, isn't it? You know, it's free. It just pours out all day long. You know, we can capture it and use it for the good of our nation, our globe, really. So, very good. Well, Marco, thank you so much for today. I hope that you've covered everything that you wanted to.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving this idea of new way how to think our industry, giving that some stage, and looking forward to see. And by the way, there will be soon an announcement of, let's say, Everest-based product in UK, which is also quite volume, so it's not a niche one. And so maybe you can even see the first products.
Well, probably please do let us have as soon as you get to a point where you can share something, do share it with
us.
Always
takes 2 years before I can speak about a collaboration. This is so annoying, but I will come back to you.
I tell you what, Marco, one thing that I would really, really love to talk to you about is how you went through being a startup and the lessons you learned from that, because our industry is full of startups and we're seeing quite a few struggling to make that jump from brilliant idea, first product through to commercial success. I wonder if at some point we might do another podcast with you where we look specifically at startups and what is necessary to go from idea through to commercial viability. Would you do that with us?
I would love to do that. Yeah, for sure.
Super. Okay.
Good man.
Today. Well, and on that note, everybody, so head over to the EV Cafe webpage where we have all of our podcasts. Amazing collaboration has been demonstrated today. And I know that John and I have walked away with a hell of a lot more information than we did. And understanding, I think, is important, right? Because my challenge at the beginning of today was help me, the six-year-old in the room, understand this, what is a relative complicated, challenging thing for the layman. And I've walked away feeling I really get this, and I get the power of community and the communication and the collaboration, which we knew about, but how it relates here.
It's harnessing it. I think that's the thing. It's how you harness that. We know that an orchestra is far, far better than having a number of different musicians all playing on the street at the same time, but different tunes to different beats. What I think Marco does brilliantly is he conducts that orchestra. And those are the lessons that I'd love to unpick.
And it's super, super hard to get everything. It's like a bag full of, I don't know, ants, which are all try to go in this direction. But it's, on the other hand, also fun because it feels like something really big we're doing here. Like, can we tiny startup do that?
But you can.
Let's do that next time.
Fantastic. Well, that's all we got time for, everybody. Thank you for listening. I truly hope that you will come back for more. Clearly connect with Marco Müller, and Müller is spelt with M and the two dots. What do you call that over the O?
Umlaut.
Ooh. Umlaut. There you go. And I've just made balloons come on the screen somehow. Don't know how I did that. Let me see if I can do that again. No, I can't. Anyway, before the kids get distracted by the shiny things, the hearts and everything, thanks again, Marco. Please do connect with Marco. Check out the Everest project, and it's E V and Everest, and also link in with Pionix, P-I-O-N-I-X. You will be amazed at what can be achieved with communication, collaboration, and the other C, which was community. Just checking. Thanks, everybody, and have a great day.